Hello and welcome to today's Continued Conversation, the podcast of the International Academy for Leadership, or IAF. Today we continue a conversation we began in our Liberty Campus, a special seminar to mark the 30 years of IAF's work and development at the Theodor Heuss Academy in Gummersbach, Germany. Our Liberty Campus has brought together around 40 participants and experts from all over the world who work in the fields of liberal philosophy, policymaking, and leadership. In a very intense week, we deep dived into and worked on important topics and challenges we liberals are confronted with in our political work. We have looked at the current state of liberalism, its proponents, and organizations around the world. We have, for example, examine shortcomings and possible ways forward for political parties and movements. And this conversation, we would like to continue today and to further explore what it means and what it takes to update political parties for and beyond 2025. I'm Bettina Solinger, I'm the head of the IAF, and as always, I'm joined by Sven Gerst, a philosopher, political thinker, and long-standing facilitator for IAF. Welcome, Sven. And it's really not an easy question to ask a German liberal in these days, but how are you today? And who will be our guest with whom we are thrilled to continue our conversation?
Well, Bettina, I'm kind of ambivalent. I'm in between emotional states. On the one hand side, I think the sun is shining outside, but on the other one, I'm thinking very hard about a question that we tackle today, because we are recording this right after the German elections, which have passed a couple of weeks ago, but the emotional realization that the liberals won't have representation in the German Bundestag is still just sinking in. So that is kind of the other side of the emotional coin that I'm going through at the moment. But that, I think, makes our conversation much more relevant that we have today with Josef. And now diving into things, our listeners will already know, I always hesitate to introduce other people, although Josef and I have worked together in the past, but I always think it's more charming if our guest is introducing themselves in kind of an elevator pitch. So Josef, thanks for joining us. And what should people know about you?
Hi, Bettina, Sven. Thank you very much for having me. My name is Josef Lentsch. I'm Austrian, based in Berlin. I'm a political entrepreneur, which means that I'm an entrepreneur, but I have also been active in politics for quite a long time. My most recent enterprise is Partisan. It's a community of political professionals, which has just organized the Political Tech Summit, Europe's first, in Berlin in January 2025.
Yeah, and we will focus, of course, mostly on the earlier contributions that you made to our discourse, which is your books on political entrepreneurship and then later on intrapreneurship. Of course, we are also very interested in kind of the future of politics, and let's see how we touch upon that topic. But again, it is the time to discuss really the fundamentals of party politics in the liberal bubble, we feel. Not only because in Germany, the FDP has been kicked out of parliament, so to speak, but we see pressures on liberal parties all over the world. So I was just in Vilnius the other day, and also here in the last election, one of the two liberal parties didn't make it to parliament. And in general, we see that a lot of political parties come under pressure. Some of them are succeeding, others have surrendered to the pressures, if we look at Spain and Ciudadanos to a certain degree. And so that's kind of our hook and the way we set up this conversation. Before we dive into the problems that the liberals are facing on an organizational side, I just want to ask you, you're saying you're a political entrepreneur, and that is kind of a weird terminology for me. Are you an entrepreneur? Are you like, or are you a politician? What's kind of your origin story? How did you come to politics and this weird field that you define yourself of political entrepreneurship?
So I'm one of those people who ran for the first time for student council at the age of 10. I come from a political family, so I've been always somehow around politics. And then I was, of course, also part of the student council at university. And some of the people, you know, walked with me, so to say, through the institutions, like it sometimes is. And then, you know, in the 2000s, in the early 2000s, really, and then 2010s, those people and also probably me in another time would have gone into the existing political parties, like the Conservatives, the Greens, There was at the time, there was for some time, there was a Liberal Party as well in Austria, the Liberale Forum, but then it went out of parliament again. However, this whole cohort of people who were centrist, I would say, some more liberal, some more conservative, some more green, and so on, they didn't go into the existing parties because there had already been an estrangement taking place, which we see, I think, much more pronouncedly. But back then, it already started. So quite a few people were actually then founding their own companies or going into business, going into the civil society, not going into political parties. And that way it stayed for a while until Matthias Strolz and Veit Dengler, the two co-initiators of NEOS back in the day, said, we need to do something. And then they called a few friends up. I was among them. And we convened 40 people for a weekend retreat to discuss what needs to be done. And the result, a little later then, happened to be NEOS. Of course, happy to provide more detail on that.
Yeah, let's go right into the details of NEOS. So I don't think all our listeners will be familiar with Austrian politics. And so maybe it's good to give a little bit of an overview of NEOS, which I would describe in its origins like very much a startup party. And we have kind of heard that terminology now for a couple of years. As you said, in the past, I think that led to the estrangement that you were talking about. In the past, we know the kind of traditional establishment parties. But what we see over the last decade or so is that we have much more volatility in the election market. And that means that there's more space also for newcomers or what political scientists called challenger parties. So what was NEOS's motivation? And maybe you speak a little bit about that. And how did it come around? And what was the startup or entrepreneurship angle to it? Because I think starting a party is one thing, but on the other side, like changing political culture is what you were aiming towards, like political culture, not in like mainstream discourse, but in terms of party culture, I would suppose.
Mm-hmm. Very good question. So if I may start with the entrepreneurship aspect, the best definition of entrepreneurship that I know is that entrepreneurship is about the pursuit of opportunity beyond resources controlled. So it's about leveraging things that you don't own or you don't control, that may be money, that may be social capital, that may be all kinds of things, physically immaterial ideas, that you leverage to achieve something greater. And of course, political entrepreneurship then is the pursuit of that kind of opportunity in the political context. So when I talk about political entrepreneurship, in the very narrow sense, I talk about the founding of new entities, of new political parties to change parliamentary democratic systems from within. And if you look back at the NEOS founding, then actually quite a lot of those people that were involved in the founding of NEOS were actually entrepreneurs. And if they weren't entrepreneurs, they had an entrepreneurial mindset. So to us, NEOS, and you know, you spoke about the culture, it was about thinking that you could have an impact, that you could change things, that you could pursue opportunity to leverage for good and to impact democracy for good. Now, you have to realize that back in the day, a lot of people, basically really everyone, all the pundits told us it's impossible to bring a new party into the Austrian parliament, right? And one of my favorite quotes is, it always seems impossible until it's done, right? I mean, if we would have listened to them, we would have never done it. But in the end, we actually were successful. We actually leveraged ourselves and the party and the ideas into the parliament. NEOS, and I think that's important to understand, back in the day in Austria, a liberal was a bit of a dirty word, kind of a lot of ambivalence around it. That partially had to do with the fact that Austria, funnily enough, you know, despite the economic school, doesn't have a liberal tradition in the political sense, because there was the so-called Third Camp, which was after the Second World War. After the Social Democrats and the Conservatives, the third group or the third party, and this was the Freedom Party, and those were the Nationals and the Liberals. And then, of course, under Jörg Haider, that split into the Nationals, and then on the other hand, the Liberals, Liberal Forum. So suddenly Austria had a liberal party, but there wasn't a real tradition to refer to. And all of this led to us back in the day, basically not calling ourselves liberals ideologically, but post-ideological party. That was also a bit, I would say, you know, fashionable back in the day to call yourself beyond ideology, because ideologies back in 2012 were not very popular. So while we were liberal in terms of values, we had values like being, you know, responsible for yourself. Freedom, of course, was an important value. We did not call ourselves liberal, and we were liberal in spirit, but only got to call ourselves liberal, and of course, also then became members of the European ALDE party later on.
So yeah, so you started against all odds, so to speak, according to mainstream and political competitors. But could you name a few of your main takeaways of how it is to really found a party?
Absolutely. So to found a party is, and this is why I also chose the term political entrepreneurship, it is to a large degree like founding a new startup. We were entrepreneurs who wanted to have an impact, who wanted to change the Austrian political landscape and the system, and of course policies. But we didn't have lots of money. We didn't have celebrities. You know, in Austria, I don't know, somebody who's on ski or a footballer, you know, somebody like that might have helped us. Although we've seen with other parties who had celebrities, that it's also, you know, sometimes a challenge or a burden. But we didn't have the privilege or the luxury to have a lot of visibility right from the start. We were basically 40 people, of course, some of them, you know, more at the center, who wanted to do things. So we needed to organize ourselves. So we founded task forces. Some task forces worked on the policy platform. So, for example, they worked on domestic policy or education policy or foreign policy, and started to develop like prototypes of program chapters. And other task forces, they worked on organizational questions like communication, like the brand, like fundraising. All of those task forces were led by volunteers, and nobody got paid. And we set up a process, and I think this is really, really important to understand. It was a very participative process from the very beginning. Actually, for the first meeting, we had expected 15 people, you know, 15 and not 40. So I was surprised that there was so much interest. And this led us to immediately having to work with large group methods, because you cannot work with 40 people with traditional methods. So this became part of the DNA of NEOS. It's not just about the program and the policy and the substance. NEOS was also always about the process, being very open, being very transparent, being very participative, grassroots driven and leadership. So there were, you know, quite a few design choices that we made in the beginning very consciously. And of course, we looked at the more traditional parties in Austria and said, what do we not want to become? And how do we not want to do things? And keeping that in mind, then we said, all right, we want to be the most transparent party, for example, in Austria. And that has a choice, that has a consequence as a choice for your organization, for your culture, for your leadership, for your accountability, for all of it, right? Of course, it's much easier to do that on a white sheet of paper where you can start from scratch than doing it with an existing party, which we can discuss later.
Yeah, maybe I jump in there already for one thing, because I'm very interested at the moment and like understanding what is the minimal viable product that we can go into. So like before I studied philosophy and kind of ruined my career, I have an MBA from a business school, right? So I studied business and I was very interested in entrepreneurship, and I'm very driven to always go out with really the minimal viable product, yeah, the MVP. And so for business, that seems rather straightforward, although it's very hard to do. Any entrepreneur will tell you it's very hard to find the fine balance of what is this MVP that we can go with. Now for politics, it's even even worse because there is the comparison of the establishment parties, right? And so to go out with a minimal operational setup seems problematic, at least to a certain degree. And we have seen it now in Eastern Europe that some parties are bleeding out immediately or after one election cycle, they don't make the transformation. How do you think about this? Does this business language help us? And is there something that you had in mind that you said, okay, this is our minimal viable product, our minimal viable party that we go out with to test it with our electorate? Or do you say, no, we have to think differently in terms of politics?
I think it's a very smart way to think about startups and organizations in more generally, but also new products, you know, in terms of the minimum viable product. So I'm not sure we used that particular language, but I mean, in the end, we really followed that idea. For example, and this relates to the homework that you need to do. And this is where already quite a lot of new parties like political entrepreneurs fail because they don't see this homework or they don't want to do it. One, for example, essential aspect of the minimum viable product is money. In Austria, but also in Germany and in other countries, you cannot run as a political party. You cannot compete as a political party. You certainly cannot hope to be successful without money. Now, for us, the question then was thinking about the minimum viable product. If we want to run, and you know, we had about 1.5 years looking forward to the next election, which took place in autumn 2013, and we were founding or you know starting in spring 2012, so 18 months. We asked around people who understood politics and the Austrian political system, how much money do you think we will need to be successful, or at least to have a shot at getting in? And the number that we then arrived at was 2 million euros. In the end, I think we arrived at probably 1.6 really raised, right? With different kind of deals, with backing, of course, with small donations, bigger donations. So we made it, in fact. But you need to know this number. And for every political system, of course, in Germany it's much bigger because it's a much bigger political system, bigger country. And in other countries might be smaller, but for every country, there is a number that you need to know, that you need to raise against. And just like that, you know, there are certain, just like that, there are signatures you need to bring, for example, legal requirements, right? So when we talk about a minimum viable product in the political sphere, there are a lot of requirements. And this is why already new parties or political startups fail at this first challenge.
Yeah, let me jump one more time in, like, because besides the capital itself, I would be very interested in the human resources aspect of things. With how many people in the leadership did you run? Because I think there's something weird about new political parties in terms of their sociology, at least in Germany or in many of the political societies I operate in, that there's a reason why they are not in an established party. they attract kind of weird people, and there's a reason they are not in established parties, right? So with which kind of human resources did you say, we go out and that is our leadership and this is the people that we run with? Because of course you cannot be only focused on one or two celebrities. We have seen that with some parties that it does work, but on the other side you want to have enough manpower, so to speak.
Yeah, so jumping to the time of founding NEOS, which was in autumn 2012, so about 1 year ahead of the federal election of 2013, I think overall we were about 250, 300 founding members. So it wasn't a super small group, but it also wasn't a super large group that got together and you know, attended the founding congress. I was a founding board member. The founding board was, I think it was seven people. And those people, some had political background, some didn't. Matthias himself, who then was elected chairman, he was also an entrepreneur. But also, and I think that's important to know, he has worked as an organizational consultant, as an advisor, with a very strong understanding of organizational leadership, culture, structure, processes. So that was very important to have somebody who really knows how to build an organization, you know, what, how to think about an organization in the leadership. I think that was very important. And this is why NEOS to this day is still very successful, because, you know, again, this led to certain choices. But then there was also Veit, who had been, you know, in an executive in really big companies, who had been COO. So there was somebody who was operationally really strong to, you know, and in terms of KPIs, which you mentioned earlier, you know, managing an organization efficiently, aligning it and so on. So there was a lot of expertise in the leadership. But then, of course, there were also some very political people like Beate, of course, right from the beginning, who is now the foreign minister of Austria, who had a very, you know, strong kind of policy view on things, as she had been in politics before. I had been working as an entrepreneur as well. I had been in the civil society and with working with NGOs. So, you know, there was a lot of kind of, I think for any organization, if you start, the balance, you need to get the balance right. That's crucial. And for example, that means in the beginning, particularly for a founding board, you need to have a group that is homogeneous enough. If there's not enough homogeneity in the beginning, the centrifugal forces will tear the organization apart. However, when the organization grows and you scale it and you become a proper party, and in our case, then this was when we entered parliament and then suddenly had state organizations and regional and local organizations, of course you need to diversify. So this homogeneity, you know, needs to transition into something more diverse. And of course, you know, the all of those phases, the first phase is the transition phase and then the scaling phase, all of those have their own challenges. I think what we got right, we established a very strong culture from the beginning. So Matthias spoke to us, you know, to the inner circle, but also to the members every time about the values, every time about what we stand for, why we do what we do. You know, of course, I had heard that numerous times within a few weeks and months. But what was important about that, he really, really put that into each and everyone's muscle, right? Not just in the brain, but it became something, you know, the 5-6 values that we started with. Really, everybody was aware of them, and it became really important for how we acted, why we acted, what we did. We referred to it, you know, externally in the public, but also internally. So this kind of this leadership of creating a culture and then cultivating a culture, which then also led to certain design choices in terms of processes and structures, was really, really important. So in that sense, you know, the organization was very consciously designed.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting. For me, it sounds like in the middle or the gravity center was the set of values and a very clear why you are doing this, where do you want to go with this. And then around that, you built a team you had that were all aligned with the same values and had the same motivation and the same why in front of them, why they are doing this. And then there was a team with that was also heterogeneous as well as homogeneous, because you need different roads, you need different experts. I mean, all the political requirements to even start a party and to compete in an election. You need to build an organization. You need to have great, clear and efficient communication and all that. You need someone with an inward-looking perspective, and then those who look outwards to reach the public at some point. So did you have a clear picture of we need all the roles that you needed and then looked for the best people to put in those seats?
Yeah, I think we had quite a good idea what was needed, and that of course that was a certain danger in spending too much time looking inwards, right? And basically navel gazing. So Matthias, but also others, were very conscious that we, of course, needed to go through those loops, and we, you know, we needed a name, we needed a brand, and you know, then somebody came up with Neos, and then we discussed the color, and it, you know, we chose pink because, of course, most of the other colors were already taken, and at the end, you know, the choice was between turquoise and white and pink, and then we went for pink. And, you know, believe it or not, but some people left over the choice because, you know, in 2012, some people said, wow, you become the gay party now. That's not for me, right? So all of those choices have consequences. And of course, we looked for the best people. But in the end, of course, it was the best available people because we did not have the luxury of paying people. I mean, that was part also, of course, of the success. The walking the talk, right? I mean, Matthias gave up his job. Others did too, became volunteers, took a risk. And that makes a difference if people see that you really mean it, that you're really serious, that you're a role model. And you know, people actually threatened us. Some lost jobs, some lost projects, because of course the system wants to realize that this challenge was real. The immune system started to react. So you need persistence. You need the belief, again, you know, against all odds, that you actually can do that. And all of that, of course, has an impact on the people around you who understand, you know, we're really doing this. We really want this. We can do this. So you need to develop that kind of attitude.
And well, you throw in a lot of energy from the volunteers. I mean, that's also a huge value. It's, you can have a lot of money, but if you don't have the people who then are able to authentically make use of that, yourself just remain something superficial. But you had that. I mean, you started out there. You were successful. And now the party is also becoming a bit of age, so to speak. So to keep that entrepreneurial spirit, that, you know, that completely driven by internal motivation and so on, I could imagine it runs out or it dries out. There are also then situations where maybe success is not coming the way, or there are other problems. You lose people. You have maybe onboarded people that don't really fit but have a good impact or major impact on the party, and all these things that can happen. And then, you know, suddenly maybe you become one of the traditional old tankers, like the traditional parties around you when you look around in Parliament. So that brings me to two questions. One is, how do you avoid to age badly and maybe become a bit more rigid and lose this entrepreneurial, agile, forward-looking edge and power and energy? And at the same time, how could a more traditional party rethink themselves and escape that negative brand of being part of an establishment, doing things as always done, never mind that the world around us changes and so on. So these are two different directions, but maybe one can cross-pollinate the other. What I mean, if you think about parties like the FDP now here in Germany, but there are many parties like that. The Liberals in Canada got lucky in a way also. They could have gone the same way. So what is your take? What would you also recommend Neos and the others?
Yeah, I think you're spot on. I mean, you cannot stay a startup forever, right? I mean, you don't want to stay a startup forever. You want to grow, you want to scale. And with that comes a certain amount of structure, a certain amount of administration. You cannot avoid that. And so the question is just how do you do that, right? How do you keep it fresh, as you pointed out to? So I think some of it is really about structural and procedural questions again, and we're back to the design choices, right? For example, NEOS has term limits on basically every role, right? So you cannot stay an MP forever. You cannot stay in the board forever. So everyone knows they have an expiration date. So that's, you know, one simple way, but quite effective way to keep things fresh. Another, I think, important process choice that NEOS has made is that there is one member, one vote principle, right? So we don't have a delegate system where people get delegated to come to the party convent. Basically, everybody's representing themselves, which means, of course, those are big, even for Austria, big events. And of course, many people then, for example, participate online and then also vote digitally. But that is, of course, all possible today. But this way, you know, we try to avoid that there's a kind of an intelligentsia or some kind of elite that is estranged from the base, right? So
yeah.
So everybody. Also, there's only one party, so we needed to be creative about that. But even though Austria is a federal system, in contrast to the other parties, it's not that there's one federal party and then nine state parties. With NEOS, there's only one party, and everybody's member of the same party, which of course means that there's a much more kind of direct relation between the leadership and the members, but also between the members themselves. So those are all choices. And also, of course, the open primaries that you allow, you know, people to run against the establishment, that there's a possibility of mobilizing for yourself, that outsiders can actually make it in onto the list. So all of that, I think, is in a way, you know, not a guarantee, but it helps keeping things fresh. The other, of course, important dimension, and this is not, you know, you cannot require that legally. The other, of course, is the culture, right? The culture of a participative leadership, and that I think still, I mean, the values are still alive. This is still there, and this is still part of the DNA. And of course, it's a leadership task to cultivate them, to nurture them, to look after them, because you don't need to reinvent them. I think they're good, and I think they're part of the success story of NEOS. So you need to take care of them. And this is now, of course, with Beate and the leadership of NEOS of today. Now, to your question, when it comes to more established parties, of course, you know, there's the size dimension. So if you have a large party in a large country, if you have a traditional party that has been existing for quite a long time, then, of course, there are some challenges related to that, because you have vested interests, you have certain structures, you cannot just change everything at once. So there needs to be a process of reform, and we can talk about that, how you can set something like that up. And we can talk about examples, successful examples in party history in across different countries and party political families. But yes, you know, it's not that you push a button and then suddenly the culture is new or the structure is new. It's a very, unfortunately, often long and painful process, because parties are, and that is a fact, hard to reform and hard to innovate.
Yeah, let's maybe explore that a little bit more before we go into the case studies. When you said, of course, the culture, we got it spot on. I think that's, of course, one success story of maybe startup parties. But on the other side, I think also a challenger party has it easier, because it starts when a certain political moment is there. And so most establishment parties, at least in my books, and I wrote a longer piece on this, is like that they don't understand when paradigms shift, right, politically. And so every so often paradigms shift and new political topics become relevant and new kind of political styles become relevant. I'm thinking about my own party with the FDP here. So a challenger party naturally has it easier, because it comes at a point in time where it just reacts to the current political discourse. And we have seen it in many societies, especially Eastern Europe, I would say. Now, if we take a more holistic picture or upshot of what is going on, what do you think in establishment parties is really under pressure at the moment? Is it the way that they organize their membership? Is it the way they arrive at policy solutions or policy making? Maybe they are too attached to like of old paradigm ideas. Is it the leadership style? Is it the culture? Is it maybe the fundraising? Is it their old school style of campaigning? Is it the representation of the people inside the party? What do you think really became under pressure in the last 15 years? Because that's where we see much more volatility, obviously, in the election market.
Yeah, I mean, it, of course, that's a thing we could discuss for probably hours or days. And of course, there's not just one dimension to that. There are several. The one I'm very interested in, of course, is the organizational dimension. I think it's absolutely clear that there's also a dimension when it comes to policy and you know the accelerated change in the world and the multiple crises. That put not just, of course, parties under pressure, but also businesses, right? I mean, any organization has much more pressure now these days, right now, than perhaps this was the case of a few years even ago. So that's not just, you know, it's not exceptional about political parties. But I think what is exceptional about political parties is that, I mean, many of them have been around for a really, really long time, right? I mean, the FDP 1948, but then of course the SPD, you know, that dates back quite a while, and there are many parties still around today that have been around for decades or even, you know, 100 or more years. Now that's quite exceptional compared to companies. There are companies who are that old, of course, but one thing about political parties is they hardly die. They actually survive quite a lot. They're, in that sense, they're quite resilient. Might have to do with the fact that they're, you know, involved in making the rules. And of course, you can bend them a little bit into your favor. And from a market perspective, you could say the barrier to entry to political markets in many, many countries with, you know, perhaps exceptions, I don't know, perhaps like Netherlands, you know, with a low threshold and those kinds of things. But the barrier to entry is really, really high. And so parties are quite protected from competition. So you could make an argument from an economic point of view that there's a market problem, that political parties don't face enough competition in a way. And because they don't go out of business often, they can afford to not innovate as much as perhaps a business, because a business basically, you know, if it gets behind the competition, then it makes a loss and at some point it will go defunct, right? Not so much with political party. You can lose quite a lot and for a long time often before you actually really go out of business. So those protective forces enable political parties to, you know, be a little bit, let's say, reluctant on innovating. And this brings us to the organization question, right? I think one thing that has of course changed dramatically over the last 10, 15 years is technology. And by technology, I don't just mean, you know, social media platforms, of course, which, you know, I mean, Facebook hasn't been around that long. It, you know, when I started in 2008 in the US, it had just been founded, right? So there are many, many other things. Now AI, of course. So technological change, disruptive change is a reality. Now, if you look at the reality of you know, not just political parties, also many, you know, nonprofits and unions, associations, I mean, they are unfortunately in many ways behind that, the kind of the cutting edge, even sometimes the state of the art when it comes to taking up technology. I think technology is, you know, with all, of course, the dystopian stories that we read these days, but I think thinking about technology in terms of becoming more efficient, becoming more agile, deepening and at the same time quickening democracy, so to be able to be more responsive to citizens, to be more citizen-centric, I think there's a big, big potential in that. But so far, most of the political organizations and also parties have not been able to really capitalize on that. I mean, if you look into the databases of political organizations and parties, they're often not very well organized, right? The data is not very well looked after. It might be well protected, but it's certainly not, you know, not managed very well. So there's so much potential, positive potential for parties and political organizations in innovating their organizations. But for many, many reasons, they're very resistant to do so.
I mean, there are a lot of examples also of innovative parties, like, for example, in Germany, the Pirate Party was really innovative, very flat hierarchies and all that. But they also struggled. They didn't make it really. And there are more examples of parties who failed. They tried to innovate or come with an innovative concept, but we're not able to keep it up. And then there are other parties who say, okay, let's rethink our own organization. We need to have a fresh start. And they innovate, some make it, some don't. And I mean, you have a broad overview of political parties going more like entrepreneurs into that task of changing or innovating their party. Can you highlight some case studies or cases that stick out for you for different reasons, maybe even?
Absolutely. So, for example, the Dutch parties, right? There are two liberal parties. If we look at that political family, the more social liberal D66 and the more economical liberal VVD, and both had ups and downs in their history, right? And both are traditional parties, both have been in government, out of government. So for the VVD, of course, recently, Mark Rutte, who was the chairman and the prime minister of Netherlands, one of the most successful politicians and political leaders over the last decades, really, in Europe, having been for a prime minister for that long, he faced the situation that his party was actually about to encounter a problem. And I think this is, you know, where leadership comes in. They knew that they would develop a problem because some advisors had shown him some data and have told him, look, we need to change things because otherwise we will really crash at the next election. And that is a leadership task then to say, all right, I'm listening to the arguments and I'm making decision. And his decision was, yes, we need to change. And in their case, this meant to become closer to the citizens. The VVD had been viewed as a rather technocratic party back in the day, 2006, 2007. And Rutte also was seen as a rather kind of distant prime minister who hadn't been particularly, you know, close. He was liked, but he was not loved. So the whole communication approach changed. And of course, technology played a big role in that. You know, the way they staged him as a person, but also the way they presented VVD as a party, different in, you know, imagery. So, for example, they showed Rutte with people around him, but they also organized different kind of formats where citizens could talk back in the day, for example, in a Facebook Live session. Today it would be perhaps on TikTok or on Insta, where people could talk to him directly. And you know, all those kinds of different choices then they made to cater to the changed data. So to really make it make the image and the party work again. And it did actually work. I mean, they turned around the sinking fortunes of the VVD, and Rutte stayed on, of course, for a few more years as prime minister. So I think that's a lesson to be learned. Look at the data, listen to the advisors, and then, you know, make a choice. And that sometimes means that you as a leader have to say, all right, so we had a great run, you know, we were very successful, but now we understand that we need to change things, and that might have to do with the structure, with the process, with the communication, perhaps also with the personnel, right? It also might mean changing some persons to stay successful. Another example, as I talked about Netherlands, is the D66 party, which, you know, had a very, very bad showing in 2008 at the election. Almost was thrown out of parliament, barely made it into, with three MPs, And they started a reform process, and the kickoff really was a review that was led by someone who was respected by all, you know, factions and wings of the party, who was not in for himself. He had been a successful local politician, he had been a businessman, but he didn't have any ambition anymore to, you know, become a leader or whatever. So he took this on and then did a very rigorous review, interviewing people, reading lots of things to understand what was going wrong, why the party had been heading downwards for quite some time. And then, you know, the report was presented to a party convent. And it was really, you know, he pulled no punches when it comes to really addressing the challenges. He was still respectful to the persons. I think that's very important. You know, everybody needs to save face, even though, it, you know, of course, perhaps mistake had been made. And so this review then became the basis for making recommendations and suggestions on how to improve, for example, local organizations. In the case of D66, one conclusion was it had been over decentralized. Now, that might be different for different parties, but in the case of D66, basically there was anarchy in the party, right? So self-responsibility had turned into everybody was doing what they thought was right. There was not enough coordination. So they re-centralized, in a way, some decisions and some power on the executive, on the national level. And so the federal party became more powerful. This allowed them then to align the party more than it had been and to bring people together again. So those are some instruments and some choices, but it all comes down to leadership. It all comes down to getting a process in place, being very transparent about what you do, why you do, and then communicating it back to the party, for example, via convent, and then get everybody on board and aligned around, you know, this kind of new direction of the party.
Yeah, and when it comes to innovation, we also talk about skills. I mean, we see not only a detachment from maybe the party from the voters, but also within parties often. The local level is a bit far from the top leadership, and they do what they have always done. So if you have a strong leadership, you have a new vision or got a new purpose, and the why is more clearly defined in relation also to what is happening around you in your country or in the world. And then you have a new process, but you also taking people along also means sometimes you need to build up skills in your own party. It's not enough to just let the young organization somehow it will, you know, trickle through and somehow they will pick it up and somehow they will deliver the next generation of talents and so on. You need to have a due process for that as well. Did the two examples you have mentioned, did they do something strategically with regard to people development, skill development within the organization?
Yes. So I think that there are two dimensions to this. One is, of course, as you mentioned, skills, very, very rightly. I think you have to recruit for skills. And so that means, and we talked about that earlier, you need to be clear what skills do you need and for what roles, right? Sven, you earlier mentioned the Swedish conservatives. So they, like, for example, also Labour in Britain back in the day, you know, when they became, before they became successful at both, the Swedish conservatives and British Labour, they brought people in with a different kind of skill sets and different roles. So, for example, the front man, of course, there needs to be somebody who is the chairman, chairwoman, who sells the policy, the new image. Tony Blair, in the case of Labour, or Fredrik Reinfeldt back in the day of the Swedish conservatives. But then you also need a problem solver, fixer. You need a policy wonk, somebody who's really into, you know, programmatic issues and questions, into policy. And of course, you need a communicator, somebody who is communicating internally and externally with the press, with the media, with the stakeholders. You might also need a fundraiser who helps you, you know, get capital on board. And then there's a few other things, but those are really the central roles and skills you need. And then, of course, you need all kinds of people who help you mobilize, organize, communicate, and so on. And yes, of course, that also means, and particularly in existing, more established parties, that sometimes means upskilling people, right? That you have people in the organization and you need to train them. Now, with NEOS, this was the role of the NEOS Lab, which is the party academy, which I led back in the day for 5 years. And the role of the NEOS Lab was capacity development, upskilling people, training people, but also program development. So we, you know, when there was a new a policy to discuss or a new chapter in the program, of course, we didn't cover all the bases in the beginning, then this was with the lab, right? The content and the skills. And so what we did was, for example, we did lots of, in the beginning, of course, trainings and workshops on NEOS values, on the NEOS culture. You know, how does NEOS work? Bringing onboarding people, like you would call it in an organization, a company. But then, of course, also other bits and pieces on a more advanced level. Of course, we train people, I don't know, how to use social media and how to talk to people on the street and whatever you need for a political party. So, of course, such an academy, such a foundation, such an organization that provides that is really, really important. Because, yes, of course, you don't have all the skills all the time in the organization. So you need to have something, an institution to provide that.
Yeah, I find that highly, highly relevant because, of course, that also applies to establishment parties. It's not only to build from ground up in startup parties, but I think that is very crucial for transformation. Because even then you have a fluctuation of human personnel. And especially, like, let's say if you're in a party crisis, and there is kind of a fluctuation of establishment party members, but also of the leadership, you need to be ready to scale them up. Maybe the question more is for me on the leadership itself. And maybe there I'm biased by my own party culture of the Free Democrats in Germany. How was it to upskill the second or third row tier of the party? So of course the leadership, it always is very hard to train ultimate leadership. There is a lot of people come with their own past experiences. How was it to work with them, the elite party structure, so to speak, the first, second and third row of the party? Because I understand onboarding membership, training for the policy wonks, la la la. But how is the elite level training? Was that also something that NEOS considered or other parties where you think that is a good practice? Because I think, and maybe here it becomes anecdotal, some parties that I work with, the higher we get to the higher echelons of the party, so to speak, the less prone are those people to actually take on training. And that seems very different from the business environment where we still have, especially on the management level, like continuous development of talent.
Yeah, it's hard, right? So as you pointed out, people are busy often, you know, and that's a challenge in political parties. People don't appreciate, you know, why should I go to this training? You know, I don't have any weekends, so another day or two gone. I think, again, one important aspect of that is leadership. So, you know, back in the day, I mean, Matthias not just emphasized that training is important to him. And of course, what helped was that he had been a trainer himself and an organizational consultant. So he really valued that kind of work also from the other side as a provider. But he also, you know, if we had a summer academy, for example, where we brought together 50, 100, 150 people, really training intensely over a week or whatever it was. I mean, Matthias was there, right? And also the other people of the leadership were there. They participated in those kinds of things. So the second and the third row that you alluded to saw that, you know, it is important. The top leadership is here. They appreciate it. They didn't excuse themselves. They didn't have other priorities, right? You need to be there. You need to put in the hours, even though you might have heard about it, but there's no excuse. You have to attend those kinds of things, show yourself, show appreciation that the other people who, you know, don't get paid potentially, even though you do, you take the time from the family, from your work, and attend those kinds of sessions, workshops, and so on, right? And it's, of course, it wasn't always Matthias necessarily. Sometimes it was his deputy or another board member, but you know, that's really, really important, showing face and putting in the hours. And of course, I mean, that's, if you will, the role model nudge aspect. I mean, the other side of it is, of course, you need to provide attractive products, attractive offers, right? I mean, it doesn't make sense to have a training that is not really interesting and attractive and just to keep people pushing through it. But you need to offer nice places, nice venues, attractive trainers, practical skills. You know, if people realize this is something that I can really use, you know, not just for my political career, but potentially also for my other job that I might have, for my business, for my public institution, because it's about leadership, it's about communication, it's about, you know, intellectual enrichment, understanding of something, right? Then, of course, that's a very powerful force. And ideally, you combine those things. I don't think you can coerce people. It needs to be a mixture of role modeling and of attractive offers.
And I think in our partner network, the Democratic Alliance, of course, also comes into mind with their leadership academy that they have, where they really upskill people. And like many of the MPs, if not almost all MPs that ever are there for the Democratic Alliance, have gone through that process. And I think that is a matter of culture and appreciation for the structures. Okay, so now to close that kind of complex a little bit, Josef, I have a question on the failed projects, because if we talk about entrepreneurship, then it is really also allowing for failure, one must say. So if we allow for political entrepreneurship, there will also be startups that fail. And I think that's just the nature of the game. And I think nobody should take here as a takeaway that, well, you know, you should just start your own party. As you said, that's very difficult due to the Porter's Five Forces model, like hard barriers to entry. But also in general, we want to cultivate and be honest about the rate of failure. And especially, I think, in Eastern Europe, we see that there is a lot of party volatility and there are also failed projects. What comes to your mind, like in the last couple of years, where did you see a promising kind of a party coming up and then ultimately fading? Which, again, is not to blame. Like, it's part of the game, so to speak.
Sure. I mean, I would say most political startups fail, right? So in that sense, NEOS is a genuine exception. It's rather the rule that, you know, even if you make it, and as I said, right, most don't make it into parliament, but then I think about 30 or 50%, I don't know, have the exact number, of new political parties, once they're inside parliament, fail within the first term. And there are many, many reasons for that. Some are internal, some are external. And of course, we have to talk about leadership. We have to talk about strategic errors. But I mean, keeping, you already mentioned Ciudadanos, for example, right? Who were for a long time really, really successful and like a role model of new political parties. I mean, there were some strategic errors, some leadership errors that had really fateful consequences then. And unfortunately, the turnaround then didn't work out, so they, you know, went out of business, so to say. Or if you think about Nowoczesna in Poland, who also were really successful for quite some time, and then, I mean, they're still around, but much smaller than they had been. And, you know, they, for example, I mean, there was a famous error made when it comes to transferring some of the money from the state. And of course, back in the day, PiS, the right wing populist government party, of course, made sure that this error wasn't healed, so they didn't receive any money for the first few years, which really, you know, damaged them a lot. But there were also some leadership errors back in the day that they committed. So, you know, it's the problem, of course, and I mentioned before that parties hardly die. That's the case for established parties who have been around for a long, long time, who have embedded themselves into the political system, who have, you know, local and regional roots. So they are more resilient. But of course, when it comes to new parties, and Bettina, you mentioned the Pirates earlier, right, who were also a political startup at the time. But also, if you think about, again, about Ciudadanos, about Novacesna, about other political startups, those new parties don't have the structural roots, but they also don't have the brand that is as resilient. You know, they haven't been through lots of scandals as perhaps other parties have, and then they, you know, recovered from them. And people say, yeah, yeah, all right, that's not good, but they'll be back, right? You don't have that kind of protective shield. And of course, you don't have the financial resources, you don't have the personal resources. So once the people are leaving the ship, and you know, once your donors don't want to give the money anymore, potentially, this can lead to immediate failure or to, again, a very short-term failure. So yes, I think that's the rule. There's no shame in it. It is a fact. It is a rule that most startups fail. I think it's just that you need to draw out the learnings and then make sure that you don't make the same mistake the next time you found a new political startup.
Yeah, and I think that's like in business, right? Like most startups don't make it, and that's the nature of the game. But those that make it usually have a very promising future ahead of them. So I'm always encouraged to be part of those projects. So whether it be personal or political. Good, then let's close things out with a more takeaway question for those of our listeners that are operating in parties and the party leadership, which are some of them. If you look at the innovative processes or the dashboards of the leadership of a party, which kind of KPIs, so the key performance indicators, would you keep track of? What would you look at to see whether we are good on track, whether something worrisome pops up? What are some of the KPIs that people should have on their radar?
So at NEOS, we actually implemented a KPI-driven system also to be more evidence-based when it comes to distributing very scarce resources across nine states. Because, of course, back in the day, as a scale-up, NEOS, you know, went from one election to the next, and those cost a lot of money. So you need to be clear, you know, when there's three states electing at the same time, how, you know, who do you give what kind of support? So among those KPIs, of course, were the polls, no question about it. So these days, you know, politics is very poll driven. It you know, doesn't have or shouldn't be probably the most important indicator, but it has to be one of the central ones. How are you doing in the polls? Not just one, of course, but over a certain amount of time, longer periods. How is it going upwards or downwards? Is there some momentum related to that? Of course, for any party, it will be important to look at things like members, like personnel, like money. You know, how the finance is doing, how's the budget doing? Particularly when you look at an election, you know, how we're doing with the campaign budget, how we're doing with fundraising, are we growing in terms of resources, in terms of members, in terms of activists, and then of course. Externally facing, there might be an indicator about media presence. These days, of course, it's about social media. So how we're doing on our channels, but also how we're doing with, you know, the traditional media in terms of reports. If you look internally, and I think this is something that not many parties or not enough parties do at this point, but you know, parties like I don't know, USR in Romania. Have already done that successfully, and I think NEOS as well, is of course looking to doing member service, doing staff service. So really also taking account of, you know, are our people happy? Are our people satisfied? Do they think we are heading in the right direction? Is something we can do to improve their job, to improve their role, to add, you know, to help them gain more skills, all of those kinds of questions. So, of course, you also need to evaluate your courses, your offers, your products, your trainings for your own people. And this is, you know, how you create ideally a kind of a 360 picture. Also, you know, interviewing outside stakeholders and taking all of that together, as you said, right, in a dashboard, then creates a picture that allows you for a more strategic leadership.
Well, Joseph, you're still in the business of developing political organizations, and you had the first political tech summit in Berlin in January this year. Could you just give us a couple of takeaways and also maybe a lookout because politics and technology is more than just looking at TikTok or something like that. Maybe for all of our listeners as well, why should they try to get to Berlin in January 26 for the next tech summit?
Thanks. So for us, political technology is any technology that political organizations, not just parties, but also unions, associations, advocacy organizations, but also some businesses or public institutions are using. For us, it sits between civic tech, which aims to empower citizens with things like participatory budgeting and other technologies. And on the other hand, GovTech, of course, which is about digitizing government and public administration. So political tech is really about, of course, communication, campaigning, but also mobilizing, managing political organizations. So this is why a CRM, for example, you know, where you have your user data or your member data, but also, of course, any kind of app that helps you, you know, Canvas, for example, all of that belongs into the political technology stack of a political organization. And there's actually quite a lot happening in Europe. There are quite a lot of organizations, small, big, medium-sized, who are active. But due to the nature of European politics with its fragmentation, you know, in countries, but also along political families, nobody really knows who's out there and what's out there. And we believe that technology has a big role to play in accelerating, in deepening democracy, and in also helping kind of set the political center, if you will, from center left to center right, to regain some of its previous strength. And this is why we wanted to convene, you know, on the one hand, if you will, the demand side, so political organizations, and on the other hand, technology providers, startups, but also big tech, and get those people together. And fortunately enough, you know, more than 600 people followed our call from 40 nations in Berlin in January. And you know, we know that it really had an impact, that new partnerships were forged, that new projects were started. And this is why I'm really optimistic that we can do even, you know, more of that with an even bigger audience next January in Berlin once again, because we saw that this is a community that wanted to get together, but that had not had the chance to get together to this stage. So this was a kind of a premiere. It was the first political tech summit in Europe, and really happy how it turned out.
That's really, really fascinating. I mean, we all want to defend the way we live and liberal democracies and now have good relationship between governments and voters and citizens. Technology can help there a lot. It feels somewhat outdated when we look at some processes that are happening within organizations, but also with regard to government and with regard to shaping policies and so on. So congratulations on that successful first round, and also all the best for the next one. I can definitely, from what I have seen, recommend to our listeners to try to get there. Sven.
Yeah, we're speaking now about something more ancient, more traditional. We usually close this round and these talks, Josef, by asking our guests which kind of books they would recommend to our listeners that liberals probably haven't read yet. So maybe not recommending John Stuart Mill on liberty or something, but instead something that liberals haven't read yet. Do you have something in mind, or what would you recommend to our listeners?
So one book I've read recently and which I think I can recommend to liberals as well is Abundance by Ezra Klein and Derek Thompson, which is, of course, it's U.S.-centric to a certain degree, but it's really about the question of how, and in their case, it's probably more, you know, center-left, how progressives can win again. And of course, in the case of the U.S., that's really a crucial, really global question, I would argue. And they, I think, and this is why I found it very interesting, they take a quite critical view of, you know, bureaucracy and of the problem of ossification of processes, and that it takes so long to get stuff done, which of course I think is something that liberals very much sympathize with, and that, you know, Democrats need to think about how to tackle that. And I think, you know, for me, the larger question is, so, and I just was in Paris talking about this with the grandson of Chamonix, that, you know, there is gradualism on the one hand, and then that's kind of the total disruption on the other hand, which Elon Musk and of course Donald Trump now stand for, and their approach of disrupting U.S. government. And I would argue, you know, and this is why it's a false dichotomy, I would argue that neither of the two, if you will, extremes are what we need right now. And I think this is also in line with the argument that Thompson and Klein make, is that we need disruption because we need to accelerate the change and the reform and democracy. We're in a race against time, right? We see changes, but it's not the changes that Trump and Musk make right now. But at the same time, we cannot wait 10, 20, 30 years for, I don't know, education systems or business administration to change. We need what I would call a disruptive gradualism. We need to do it step by step, but in a very much quicker, more accelerated pace, with the aim to positively disrupt the systems that we have. And this is what I think Klein and Thompson show and make some suggestions on. This is why I think it's a very good book also for liberals.
Yeah, definitely. And that is a jumping board for just a plug to our recent seminar, where we said abundance liberalism is one of the allies that liberals could take. I add to this the book by Mark Dunkelman, which is Why Nothing Works, which goes like hand in hand almost with the Ezra Klein abundance agenda, which I think would be neat to translate to, for example, to European or to other contexts, I think. But that's something we will explore hopefully in the future, maybe not with Ezra Klein himself, but with other abundant liberals. I think a very promising ally in this discourse. Also a nice transition from our last episode where we discussed about Javier Milei, which also is about some sort of disruption, but much less than I think the popular discourse makes around it. So in any case, thanks to Josef for joining us, for being so generous with your time, and for so many examples that you provided us. I think we will also link to your books and publications that you recently had, and of course to the Political Tech Summit, in case people got the appetite to at least follow and then register in January 2026 for it. Thanks, Josef, for joining us, and for all the listeners, make sure to spread the good works and the good word about this podcast to everybody else. Like and subscribe, as they say, and catch you in the next episode. Thank you very much, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you.